I'm not really ready to cut into and eat a slice of humble pie just yet. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
And you know what? I was a skeptic for a long time on your theory. I did come around, and I haven't left yet.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that, and I hope that a lot of people who are listening won't leave yet either, although, by appearances' sake, Chuck, I was totally wrong. Now, for those who aren't regular listeners of the program, what I'm talking about is for a while now, at least a good year or more, I have been putting forth a theory. And my theory is that ultimately, in this 2020 election cycle, that the ultimate outcome of it is going to be basically one of two things. And that is that the Democratic Party would have Joe Biden be their nominee, which that's what it's looking like right now.
Yeah.
Now, and I want everybody to be careful here, because remember, politics, if you there's an old saying that says that a politician's promises are written with water in sand.
Yeah.
on a beach.
Invisible ink.
Basically invisible ink, so it can always change and it's always fungible. But so the first scenario was they stick with Joe Biden and he picks some running mate who actually is a train wreck. And the Democrats basically have decided that they can't beat Trump and they're giving up the ship. The other theory, and this is the one that I am still holding to, even though all evidence to the contrary says that I'm completely off base on this and that it's actually the first scenario that's happening, is that the Democrats do a feint. Joe gets to the convention and maybe even gets through the convention, but that ultimately the Democrats do a bait and switch, and in an October surprise, Michelle Obama becomes the Democratic nominee. Now, everybody will be like, but wait a minute, Barry, Joe Biden just came out earlier this week, and picked a running mate, and it's not Michelle Obama. And I would look at them and say, you're absolutely correct. That's exactly what happened. But then I would caution you that, first of all, Joe Biden picked the running mate. Okay? That is a key to the whole thing. Joe Biden picked his running mate. He picked Kamala Harris, the senator from California, who formerly was seeking the nomination for the Democrats for president herself. And if you remember in that long, drawn-out, painfully boring series of debates that the Democrats had amongst them when they had, what was it, Chuck? 22 different people who were interested in running, and they had to split it, and you had two tiers, and the ones who did like certain polling or raised so much money got on A tier, and the rest of them had to settle for B tier. Well, Kamala Harris spent a lot of time during those debates doing one thing, Chuck, attacking and beating up Joe Biden on his history on race, on his history on you name it. So to have Joe come out now and pick Kamala Harris as his running mate, is that supposed to be a signal that the establishment gentrified white wing of the Democratic Party is putting out a olive branch to the progressive, liberal, non-white wing of the party? I don't think so. I think the problem is that Joe Biden made the pick. And ultimately, Chuck, you know how this works. Either the candidate is very strong and they make the pick themselves, or the party big money power broker insiders put pressure on them to pick somebody. Okay? I don't believe Kamala Harris has a large enough base of the mega donors and the super delegates of the Democratic Party for them to have forced her on Joe Biden. I believe that Joe Biden picked somebody because, frankly, he thought that's all he could have. Here's my continuing scenario on this. They're going to get to the convention, which, you know, as you hear this on Saturday, the convention, I think, is what, 6 days away. From Saturday, maybe less than a week. I think it happens in the next week. You are going to see, I think, what might be a colossal train wreck, Chuck. I thought that they might hold off until the first debate with Trump to have Biden come out there and start falling apart, which if you...
Well, look, he's already...
If anybody's paying any attention in at least the last 6 months, you understand that there is a significant cognitive ability problem with Joe Biden. Whether it's senile dementia, whether it's Alzheimer's, whether it's, you know, maybe he's had a minor stroke or two that they're just not talking about, Biden's cognitive abilities seem to be impaired. Not right now to the point of saying that he is no longer able to move forward, but I think that day's coming fairly soon. And I think that day's coming whether he wants it to come or not. Because I believe that the DNC is going to start looking at numbers. And, oh, speaking of numbers, Chuck, if you've seen the latest polling data, Biden has slipped from, we were talking last week about it being like double digits to single digits. Now we're falling within margins of error and potentially even ups in a number of battleground states.
And remember, those are fixed polls.
Yes, those are ones that are oversampling Democrats and liberals, and in big cities, and they, you know, because a lot of people in the rural areas, you get a phone call from a pollster, what do? You hang up.
You hang up, or you lie.
Well, you and I would take the call, and we would have fun with it.
Oh yeah.
But that's just because we're wired that way. But the average person, unless government like intersects with them in a negative way, they rarely ever think about government other than what they see on the TV. So when they get calls from pollsters, you know, a lot of people feel very uninformed. And so they don't poll. They refuse to do it. And sometimes this pollster asks, well, is there anybody in the household who'd be willing to do it? You know, because their whole goal is they got to get some raw numbers, you know. They have to actually have a sample size that actually has some statistical significance. And so they'll do it. So they might get some, they might, you know, you may call John Smith and John's mother, Gertrude, is sitting there, and she's probably about as, you know, cognitively functionable as Joe Biden is, and they hand her the phone because he doesn't want to deal with it.
Yeah.
Well, she's happy to talk to somebody, you know, whatever it might be, and I'm not trying to be stereotypical, but she's happy to talk to somebody, and so she'll give them all kinds, and a pollster, and you and I both know this because we know how polls are conducted, we know how polls are written. Depending on how you ask a question, you can get all kinds of responses from people, just depending on the emphasis you put on a certain word, what word choice you use, what order you put the words in, and how many different ways you say it in different questions in order to get them to see if they'll flip their script.
I've played the game with pollsters before, and I actually had a pollster call me once. This is when I had a landline, because they're not supposed to call you on a cell phone. This is when I had a landline in Westerville, and I got a call. And I was playing with the pollster a little bit, but I was also, I was being as nice as I could be. I wasn't being nasty. And she asked, she starts in, and about the fifth question in, I go, I already know who you're working for. You do? She goes, who is it? Because I don't know. And I said, you're either working for the Ohio Education Association or the National Education Association. Really? What makes you think that? And I said, you've given me, the way you've asked those questions is, you've given me two non-viable options and asked me to choose between them. She said, and I said, what was my answer? And she goes, neither, which isn't one of the choices.
Which,
and
is,
I go,
which isn't one of the ones.
And I'm like, well, that's the one I picked, and that's the one I'm going to stick with. And I know I'm going to screw up your, you know, they'll throw this result out, but
that's actually, you may not, because sometimes when you get the callers on polls, if they get somebody responding like that, they just fill in what they think that they mean.
Well, so, that's true.
So your poll could be completely skewed.
And they also asked me, so the girl, would you be willing to be on a board, on a committee? Yeah, I'll be on a committee.
Blue Ribbon Panel.
And I told her, I said, they'll never call me.
Of course not.
Because you're working for the OEA and the NEA, and they know that somebody who actually thinks independently has no business on one of their boards or committees. So, yeah, put my name in, but I won't get a call. And she kind of like, okay, I'll do that. And I'm like, that's fine. But also, Barry, as we all know, that's the way polls are done. And like you said, they do oversample the groups that they want, and they admit that they oversampled Democrats. Why? Well, the country leads more Democratic, so therefore, now are they sampling necessarily people most likely to vote?
No. As a matter of fact, oftentimes they're not even sampling registered voters unless they specifically ask that question. And again, a lot of people think they're registered to vote who aren't.
Yeah. Yes.
And secondly, Chuck. Are you? I could ask. You know, we're here in studio today, and my daughter's has ridden with me to do some things today, and so she's sitting way over in the corner now. She's turning 17 years old. So if I were a pollster, I called her up and I said, "Are you likely to vote?" And I didn't say this year. Well, of course she's going to say yes because she's looking forward to being registered voter and voting.
Yeah,
she's likely to vote. They'll put her down as a likely this year voter. And run. And so, honestly, the data is skewed already. And of course, we all know that polling is just a snapshot of what people were thinking day before yesterday. And that thinking has already changed by the time the poll numbers come out. Be that as it may, back to Biden and Kamala Harris. So, Joe's picked Kamala, but I still seriously believe, and I thank you for continuing to ride shotgun on this crazy train, Chuck, that during the convention, there is going to be, I thought it was going to, if they would have picked Michelle, if he'd have picked Michelle as his running mate, as I was thinking he was going to do, then I would have figured they would have gotten through the convention, and then somewhere toward the end of September, maybe after the first debate with Trump, the party would have been wringing their hands, and the big money guys would have been coming in saying, this guy's going to lose it for us, he's a train wreck, he basically, because Trump is going to hand him his lunch at a debate, okay? There is just no way around it. Joe can't think clearly enough to beat Trump. Matter of fact, as we've seen, there were 16 Republicans who couldn't think clearly enough to beat Trump, and most of them had their cognitive abilities intact. Well, John Kasich notwithstanding, since he seems to have has a split personality and is now speaking at the Democratic National Convention next week. Yeah, that's right. Your former Republican Ohio governor is going to be one of the keynotes at the Democrat National Convention. Let that sink in, ladies and gentlemen. So the next time, Chuck, somebody tells you or me, oh, we've got to get this guy in here into office because he's better than the Democrat,
right?
I'm going to just say two words to them. John Kasich. That's all I have to say to a lot of our friends because they all know they made a colossal... Well, actually, they made a colossal mistake and then they doubled down on it because I can say two other words to them. Mike DeWine. But be that as it may, Mike's not speaking at a Democratic National Convention to support Joe Biden for president openly. John Kasich is. If you don't believe me, folks, look it up. It's happening. Kasich has confirmed that he's speaking at the DNC.
Right.
Okay? It's ridiculous. Okay, so anyhow, they were going to... So he hasn't picked Michelle, so it's going to happen. I think it's going to happen at the convention. When Joe gets up to give his speech at the convention, his nominating acceptance speech, I think we're going to see a cognitive collapse. It's going to be a lot of pressure. I think the DNC are going to, you know, push some things in order to see if they can't get him to fall apart, so that then they can go into emergency session with the super delegates. Now you got to remember, folks, the Democratic Party treats their nominating a little bit differently than the Republicans do. The Republicans, we base it pretty much solely on the results of the primary elections in the states and who wins the majority of those states. And again, remember, in every state except two, we have winner take all, which even includes the primary to get delegates, because you have the same number of delegates as you have electoral votes in that state. So if you win the primary in a state and Trump here wins Ohio,
right,
et cetera, Biden won Ohio, et cetera, for the Republicans, Trump would get all of those electoral votes. Those 17 electoral votes would go to Trump, or those delegates would go to Trump for the nomination at the party convention. For Joe, it's a different story. Even though he won the state, and he should have 17 delegate count locked down for Ohio, the DNC has a thing that they call the super delegates.
All right.
These are delegates. It's like Animal Farm, Chuck, the old George Orwell novel.
Yeah.
On the Democratic National Committee, all the delegates
are equal,
except the super delegates, who are more equal than others.
The rest. Yeah.
That's basically, they're the pigs, okay? They're the mega donors. They're the big power brokers, and they're the former major officials. Hillary Clinton is now a DNC superdelegate.
So is Bill.
So is Bill. So is Barack.
So is Barack. So,
you go down the list. If you think of all the big names in the DNC, from Rahm Emanuel to Terry McAuliffe to James Carville, although they may have reneged on James Carville's card because he's been critical of the DNC for a while now. he thinks they've lost their way, but it's okay.
But the
point is, the superdelegates can weigh in, and they can basically negate the results of primary elections in the states. I mean, if the superdelegates get together and they as a block decide that they don't want Joe Biden to be their nominee, Joe Biden's not going to be the Democratic nominee. I don't care if he won all 50 states' primaries.
The superdelegates can't vote until the second ballot.
Second ballot, that's right.
And if nobody's nominated on the first, which is a possibility. I mean, we've discussed this before. Then the second ballot, the superdelegates are voters. Voila. I mean, it's a done deal.
And it's a done deal that they could be switching horses completely.
And
I'll just be quite frank with our listeners. Under no circumstance is it going to be Kamala Harris becoming the nominee for the Democratic Party. That ain't happening. She's got too much baggage.
Oh.
She's too polarizing. I know the New York Times and others are now trying to spin this tale that she's a centrist moderate, which makes me have to laugh. Which means that they're going to be spinning that Joe Biden is a flag-waving, patriotic, Republican conservative, if that's the case.
Right. Well, okay. First of all, I just read an article that basically said Kamala Harris's poll numbers in California before the California primary, before she pulled out.
Right.
If you recall, she pulled out.
She pulled out.
Yeah. Basically because of Tulsi Gabbard putting a torpedo right smack in the engine room and setting off all the explosives in the hold. She went down like a...
It was probably one of the most effective takedowns of a candidate's entire reason for being that I think I've seen in modern era. I mean, Trump is good at like needling his opponents in the primary, like when back in 2016 with the small hands and the whole nine yards and everybody he belittled. and some people hate Trump for that, and it's like, yeah, I get it, but okay. But the point is, Tulsi Gabbard took facts. And she filleted Kamala Harris's entire reason for being.
Yeah, but back to this. Do you know what her poll numbers were in the California primary before she pulled out?
It's probably in the low teens.
She had 7%.
Okay, it was even worse than that.
People in California know all about her.
Yep.
Now, does that mean that she and Biden wouldn't carry California? Oh, I'm not that stupid.
Well, but I don't care. You could put a dead horse and a frog on the Democratic ticket, and they'll carry California. Okay, that's just California. Now, in some of the northern ends of the state, and some like in Vallejo and some of those other places, yeah, you're gonna pay, if you're a Republican, you're probably gonna win those precincts, or you may win a couple of three counties. But because, again, as I mentioned, California is also a winner-take-all state when it comes to assigning electoral votes.
Right.
You ain't getting anything, Jack, because the Democrats are taking all 56.
Yeah, so. that's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So her overall support, I mean, if you look at the numbers, she's not well-liked. She's not well-respected. Even people who worked with her in California are quick to say... No better way to put it, she slept her way to the top.
That's no secret. I mean,
no.
Willie Brown, who was the former fixer in L.A. and a Democrat operative, basically they both admitted that they carried on extramarital affair with each other. So, and he was like her mentor, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But the other thing that, she's got, she has what I call the John Glenn problem. Without actually being an astronaut and having all that fame, which covers up a lot of your indiscretions, there's an article today in Breitbart News. Kamala Harris failed campaign still owes $1.1 million to vendors.
I think John Glenn died still owing some huge amount of
$3.2 million. Yeah. Yes. And that was in old money terms, so it was probably a lot more than that if you think about the inflation. But so Kamala Harris is already setting on, I mean, Joe brings her on the ticket. She's setting on $1.1 million in debt, which the DNC will probably have to.
They'll have to suck it up.
They'll have to pay that, which if you know anything about the DNC right now, Chuck, they're not exactly what you consider a flush cash cow. The DNC's having trouble raising money. I wonder why. You had bruising primaries where the Bernie wing of the party is, you know, completely going off the left end. And you see it in cities like Portland and Seattle and Milwaukee and Chicago and Atlanta and other places. Folks, that's the Bernie crowd. The Antifas and the BLM stuff, that's more the Bernie crowds. You're not getting, I mean, are these people going to vote? God knows if we even have an election where you can go vote. But, and we'll talk about that in a little bit here too.
Right.
But, you know, the whole point is that these are those people that they would be counting on to start with. They figured out they had to appease somehow. The reason why the whole mantra was that Joe Biden had to pick a black female on the ticket was not just the BLM issue, but it was he had to pick a black female hardcore progressive. And he couldn't pick Tulsi because she isn't African American. She's Hawaiian Islander, which even though that's an ethnic minority, it's not ethnically minority enough.
Strictly speaking, neither is...
Neither is Kamala Harris.
Okay.
That's,
you know,
right.
Oh, by the way, have you heard the controversy about Kamala versus Kamala?
No, I have not. And frankly,
Tucker Carlson's a racist because he mispronounces Tulsa.
Kamala Harris.
It's actually Kamala.
By her saying,
yes. All the white people who are mispronouncing it are doing it because they're racist.
Well, old Joey O'Bliss.
Well, look, the news media has been mispronouncing it. The mainstream media. So, no. Not so much. Now, I also just read an article that is questioning whether Kamala/Kamala is eligible to run under the citizenship clause.
You know what? I'm sitting here flipping through my pocket constitution. These are handy things to have, folks, especially in this day and age. I think we really should come back and look at our constitution much more closely. That, you know, we do have a little clause in here. It's a fun little clause about what it takes to qualify to be considered for presidency. Okay, now, yes, and some wags will say, but Kamala Harris isn't running for president. She's on the ticket as vice president. Yeah, but that's a heartbeat away from the presidency, and if anything happens to the president-elect or the president once the elections are over with, where they are unable to continue, and remember that phrase, ladies and gentlemen, because that's going to happen. They're unable to continue the functions of their office because of cognitive issues, because of failing health, because of death, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Then the vice president then ascends to be president. You don't have another election, especially if the election's over with. The VP becomes president, and then I believe that the line of succession is followed for who becomes automatically the vice president, because the president doesn't get to go out and pick a new vice president. It's already set up by the Constitution as far as the line of succession is. But in our Constitution, yes, which actually is still valid, folks, it's still our operating document.
That's it.
As much as it doesn't look like it is, if you go out and look at our cities right now, it is our operating document, and in Article 2 of the Constitution of the United States, in Section 1, in paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, fifth paragraph. Now, the third paragraph is like huge. It's monstrous.
Right.
But it's still only the fifth paragraph in. And it says, and I'm going to read this verbatim from the Constitution, Chuck. I'm not going to add anything to it, nor am I going to take away anything from it. No, folks, it's not gospel, but it is our operating charter, so therefore it has to be followed. No person, except a natural-born citizen or a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of this Constitution, shall be eligible to the office of president. Neither shall any person be eligible to that office who shall not have attained to the age of 35 years and been 14 years a resident within the United States. Now, I can see some wag saying, well, but wait a minute. She's a citizen of the United States. She's been here for more than 14 years. She grew up here. She's born. She's a natural born citizen, Chuck.
Nope, not necessarily. In fact, I have an article in front of me here mm-hmm. from the American Thinker. Mm-hmm. And it's talking about her parentage.
Yes.
Kamala Harris's mother.
Oh, and Kamala. You racist.
Kamala, yes.
You evil racist,
racist
you.
Evil racist. Old habits die hard, folks. What is the mother of a woman named Shyamala Gopalan, born in British India. And her father, her mother never became a U.S. citizen.
Okay.
And Donald Harris, who was a naturalized U.S. citizen born in Jamaica.
Okay.
The definition of a natural born citizen is not in the Constitution.
It's not in the document.
It's not in the document. However, we know where it came from, where that definition came from.
And we know that where it came from because of the writings of the founders who referenced it.
Who referenced it. I'm trying to remember. He was
Emmerich de Vittel.
De Vittel.
Yes.
Emmerich de Vittel. Emmerich de Vittel basically laid it out, the political philosophy under which the natural-born citizen idea came from. And basically what it required was born on native soil of a father who was either a citizen or a naturalized citizen. The mother didn't play into the picture. So we can reject that thing about her mother never becoming a citizen, really. But de Vittel did require the citizenship yep. passed through the father, not the mother. Unlike, for instance, Jewish heritage, which passes mm-hmm. through the mother and not yes. necessarily the father.
Right.
As you see in the New Testament with Timothy.
Yes.
Timothy's mother was Jewish. Father was a Greek. And he was considered to be Jewish because his mother was Jewish.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, now the book from which this concept is derived, which our founders read
yes.
extensively, and actually I have a copy of this book.
I have a copy of it as well.
Okay, and you can get copies of this book. They're not exactly cheap, but you can get them.
Mine's on Kindle.
Oh, then yours is cheap. Mine's paper and cloth. So, I'm not a Kindle guy. It is called, the book that this comes from is called The Law of Nations, or Principles of the Law of Nature Applied to the Conduct and Affairs of Nations and Sovereigns, and is a legal treatise on international law. So Vittel, who was Swiss, was looking at the whole body of international law, and he talked about how there are overarching principles. And one of those overarching principles was the whole idea of citizenship and the idea of being natural-born citizen. So, i.e. natural law concepts. So, you had this, and as Chuck talked about this earlier, and you pretty much quoted it almost verbatim, that you have to be, in order to be a natural-born citizen, you have to be the child of a father who is a citizen. So, that's what we get down to. So the mother thing doesn't matter. It's the father's side. And then the question is, was Kamala, whatever you want to call her, you know.
Kamala.
Yeah, a mistake, Harris. Was her father naturalized as a citizen before her birth?
Does that matter in Vittel's, political philosophy layout?
It probably does not, but I'm just saying
yeah.
for the purposes of the argument that's going to happen.
Yes.
You know, somebody's going to look at that and they're going to be like, well, he was naturalized before she was born. But if he wasn't naturalized before she was born, that argument goes completely out the window because he would not have been a citizen of the United States when she was born.
Yeah.
Therefore, because he got citizenship after she was born, doesn't make her the child of a father who's a citizen of the United States. It gets a little wiggy.
It's a little minutia.
It's a lot of minutia, but again, we're cutting a lot of hair. You know, we're splitting a lot of hairs in this culture already on a bunch of stuff. But again, when our founders wrote this idea of this prohibition against anyone but a natural born citizen, now there's that other clause that people will jump on, or a citizen of the United States. Well, Chuck, what was big about that particular issue? How long had the United States been around as a country, as an independent, separate nation from Great Britain at the time the Constitution was written?
If I remember right, the first president that hadn't been born as a natural-born U.S. citizen, in the sense that Britain had nothing to do with the territory,
right,
was Andrew Jackson?
Yes.
No, it was later.
It was later than Jackson.
It was...
Isn't it?
John Tyler, maybe.
John Tyler, I think. Yeah. Yeah. So basically, all of our presidents up to John Tyler were, quote unquote, citizens of the United States, but they had to have been here for a number of years. You know? So look at it again. It said that have been 14 years a resident within the United States. So you notice you had to have lived in the U.S. for 14 years. Chuck, you know your history. When were the Declaration of Independence written?
1776.
When did the American Revolution end?
1783 was the treaty.
The treaty. Well, and that's where you have to go by, because that's actually the formal end of the conflict.
Hostilities, yeah.
1783. When was the Constitution written?
1787 and adopted 1789.
Adopted. So between the U.S. actually being recognized separately as an independent nation from Great Britain to the ratification of the Constitution of the United States was 6 years. Folks, they had to put that clause in there, or else we would have had no leadership in the United States at all.
We could have had no president.
We could have had no president at all. But we had this little deal about they wanted to really make George Washington president. Actually, some people like John Adams wanted to make him king, but hey, you know. Be that as it may.
And Alexander Hamilton.
Yeah. But be that as it may, what you had was they had to write this clause in here about not just being a natural born citizen, because the oldest natural born citizen at the time of the adoption of the Constitution was 6 years old. That was a child that would have been born in 1783 when we became a nation. They were only 6 years old. Well, wait a minute, but you had to attain to the age of 35 years as one of the requirements to run for president.
You could.
So we couldn't have any King Edward VI.
You could argue that 1776 was actually the date, separation date.
We declared independence.
You're all the way up to 13.
13 years old.
Well, now, Declaration of Independence means you've broken the bond between you and the mother country.
That's right. You've broken a bond, but you have not
been formed the new nation.
You've not been recognized as the new nation yet, because you don't have... Well, now, you had the Articles of Confederation.
That would be 1777, because we started getting recognition in 1777.
Okay, So 1777 to 1789 is 12 years. Now, okay, folks, Chuck and I both know that, was it John Quincy Adams was a ambassador to the court of Catherine the Great in Russia at the age of 14.
Yes.
Okay, we had a formal U.S. ambassador to the Tsarist Russian court, Catherine the Great, the John Quincy Adams, the son of John Adams, the second president, who was born prior to 1777, I believe.
No,
he would have been born, well, because I forget what year that would, no, it was during, okay, that was during Washington's tenure, and Washington was president in 1791. So
1789.
So John Quincy. Then that's the case. Then Chuck, we were wrong. John Tyler. It isn't John Tyler. It's John Quincy Adams. He would have been the first person born in from 1777 forward who was up in the government long enough to become president. So, folks, sometimes we surprise ourselves as we're going through this and we start figuring out the history.
He was born in 1767.
So, okay, so he was a little bit older.
He would have been ambassador to Russia during the Articles of Confederation.
Okay, that was my mistake. All right, so scratch that. We're still back to John Tyler, so we're good. But anyhow, you know, we have an ambassador at the age of 14, but we can't have a president at the age of 13, which is what you probably would be. So by the time, now remember, folks, 1789, we ratified the Constitution. Chuck, when was our first president inaugurated?
1789.
That's right.
Our first president under the Constitution.
Under the Constitution.
There were presidents
prior
to
that. That's right. Yeah. There were 15 presidents.
But they were
prior
presidents
to that?
Of the body of the of Congress.
Right. They basically were the leadership of Congress. So anyhow, what we're getting down to, folks, is that you had to put that clause in this Constitution about a citizen of the United States because of that particular finite period of time that had to be operational. Now, that's never been removed from the Constitution, but that not doesn't necessarily extend to say that anybody who declares citizenship in the U.S. can then become president, because the first clause of this paragraph is specific. No person except a natural born citizen shall be eligible to the office of president. Now, to be eligible means you have to meet the other requirements, which is beyond being a natural born citizen is that you've got to be at least 35 years old and you've had to live within the United States for at least 14 years.
Yeah.
Those are the requirements to run for president. Kamala, Kamala, Kancha, I don't know, Harris doesn't necessarily meet these requirements because, as we said, the founders got this particular paragraph and phrasing from their reading of Imrich Vattel.
Right.
And they have written about that in their other writings, that is where the source of these ideas came from, was Vattel's writing. Now, if you look at Vattel's writing, and again, this is the same. This is archaeology, folks. Welcome to political archaeology.
Yeah.
We're digging to find the genesis of our form of government, because it's vitally important today when we are destroying statues, when we are having radical professors saying that we have to quit teaching history, that we have to burn, destroy history books, especially the biggest history book of all, the Bible. And it was just found out, Chuck, that the report has come out that, yes, they were indeed burning Bibles in Portland.
Oh, yeah.
In the chop zone or whatever you want to call it. I call it the idiot zone. Folks, this is what this is all about. This is about erasing a people's history, erasing any type of higher authority or law besides an individual's desires, wants, and needs, and creating chaos and anarchy as a means of overthrowing a culture so that you can reshape it, so you can control
right.
it.
Right.
And if you think that I've gone off the deep end and I'm a conspiracy nut, I do have a hat, but it's not made out of tinfoil. All right, but I'm not talking through it.
Right. Well, look, honestly, we talked about this. My gosh, we were talking about this with Barack Obama as president, and I think there was a stronger case that Barack Obama did not meet the criteria than her, because Barack
his father never naturalized.
Never.
Never
naturalized. And that's the whole point. You know, people would come up to me, well, he was born in Kenya and he was this and that. And I said, that doesn't matter. First of all, he was born in Hawaii. There's almost no doubt about that. The timelines are perfect. He was born in Hawaii. And the reason he didn't have a birth certificate, and they had to dummy that one up, because that's exactly what they did. Everybody knows it. And I think the people involved admitted it, that they just made it up. The reason they did that was because in Hawaii at the time, you didn't have to have one. You didn't, if you were born at home or with a midwife, you didn't get one unless you applied for it. And right. They didn't apply for it. No point in it.
No.
Really? You didn't need it for anything. Now, in Ohio, at one point, you needed it for to get your driver's license. When I first got my driver's license, I had to have it. But I think Ohio was requiring birth certificates long before I was, you know, born.
Listen, I just had to get all three of my kids their temporary driving permits because they've all decided they want to, like, get their licenses. I had to get certified copies of their birth certificates because, well, I got to looking around. I couldn't find them.
Yeah.
And so it's like, so I ended up having to go to the Franklin County Board of Health and actually ordering birth certificates online that were certified copies because that's the requirement in Ohio.
We had some issues with mine because I was born in Kansas and I was born on a Navy base.
Oh, my. So, yeah, you did have a lot of
so
fun, didn't you?
Now, it was filed with the county, so that's how we found it. But the fact is the Navy base closed about 5 months after I was born, five or six months, my dad was discharged, and I asked my mom, I said, Mom, did you know that they closed Hutchinson, the air base at Hutchinson about 6 months after I was born?
Yep.
You know, after dad was discharged, and she goes, that explains a lot, because apparently my dad was discharged early, several months early, and they just said, be on your way. You're in the reserves. And dad said, I got called for one reserve meeting, and then after that, nothing. So they never called me in for another reserve meeting, so I didn't go.
Yeah.
So mine was a little more difficult, but we have one, and I think I've had to send away for it again. It was like one of the old-time copy machine copies that came out on slick paper, and that paper was not very good, and it disintegrates after a while. And I think we had to get another copy of my birth certificate for something. But yeah,
yep.
It wasn't to run for president of the United States.
Well, what a shame.
Yes, that's right. Well, I'm actually, if you must know, I'm very glad that I decided not to run for president of the United States.
Yep.
I at one time aspired to a political career. This is long, long, long ago. And then I figured out I'm a better guy behind the scenes than I am as the front man. So,
everybody's given talents and abilities to be where God wants them to be.
Yeah.
And I'm the same way with you. I've had a number of people who've asked me, well, why aren't you going to run for, when are you going to run for office? And I look at them and say, the fifth of never.
Yeah.
Because that's not where God's calling me.
You might talk me into a township trustee position or something like that.
Yeah.
Where you're actually doing something. Mm-hmm. You're helping your neighbors.
Sure.
Get a culvert put in and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But as for aspiring to becoming a guy, here's what I've noticed about legislators. I realize that we're off track at this point, but here's what I've noticed about legislators.
Trust me, we're coming back on track.
You've got a problem, and you understand the ins and outs, and you want to get at the legislator. You know what the fact is? You have to talk to somebody who cares about that on his staff because he doesn't have the time.
Or the bandwidth.
Or necessarily the bandwidth to be able to take your issue that you know virtually everything there is to know about.
Right.
He has to get the shorthand version from his staff, and what you have to do is convince his staff.
Yes, that's true.
Which is what you do.
Yeah,
essentially,
that's basically what
that
I do.
Is your job. Now, you talk to him face-to-face for when the staff doesn't know, which is why I keep you on the string as a lobbyist. And that's why when you hear lobbyists are all bad, no, they're not. They're necessary because if you get an honest one, they tell the representative the stuff they need to hear about your issue.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because again, when you get to the Senate level, those guys are getting bombarded, like the U.S. Senate. Those guys are getting bombarded daily with so much stuff. You can see it in the hearings.
And it isn't just from their own state. It's
no.
It's all over.
When you watch them in a hearing and you say, why didn't you ask this and this and this and this? It's because they weren't immersed enough to understand
how to do
that. That was one of the key questions.
Guys like Jim Jordan are a rare breed, okay? And if you've ever watched Jordan, his marshaling of facts, and when he goes in and he's like cross-examining witnesses on the Judiciary Committee or on government oversight, oh my heavens, Chuck. I mean, he's got chapter and verse.
Yes.
And he spins these guys around like crazy. Now, why? It's because he's passionate about those issues. He's very concerned about it, so he spends an awful lot of his time and bandwidth dialing in. Many politicians don't do that, okay? They either count on their staffs to be able to do all that themselves and give them a nice, succinct, bullet point briefing on the issue so that they don't look like a complete idiot if they say something about it or ask to say something about it, or they're too busy worrying about how they're going to raise the money that the caucus wants, or how they're going to do this, or who they're going to, or, you know, which local politician's thing they're going to go to because they've, you know, they got to make a, they got to show the flag and, you know, do the kumbaya thing back home. It's all that kind of stuff.
Well, you can also see it in places like when Trey Gowdy was in Congress. Trey Gowdy, I watched him. He knew the issues and he pulled punches because he was trying to protect law enforcement. And I go, that's not your job.
Yeah.
Your job is not to protect guys in the FBI. And he's, I think he's figuring out that that turned out to be a major mistake.
Yeah, I think so.
Because I've seen him since saying, I had no idea that that some of this was happening. Because they don't believe it when it first comes up. And it sounds like a conspiracy theory. How many times have we been confronted with stuff where people come by and said, you know, I thought you were a couple of flaming quacks when you brought this up, and here we are 5 years later, and that was exactly the case.
That's exactly what was happening, yeah.
Yeah. It happens.
Yeah, well, you know, again, like I said, the crystal ball is not always clear. There's always some clouds there, but it's at least not cracked. which is the reason why I'm still hanging on this idea that ultimately Michelle Obama is really the only way the Democratic Party is going to have a snowball's chance in Hades of beating Donald Trump this election cycle. Yeah. They've tried everything else, Chuck. I mean, from Russiagate to, you know, the whole nine yards, you name it, spying, blaming him for every death that happens because of COVID,
right,
including the ones that are ginned up because they're really not COVID deaths. You know, from forcing people to wear masks to not forcing people to wear masks to supporting hydroxychloroquine to not supporting it enough. I mean, you name it, the liberals,
right,
at Nancy Pelosi and company. It's the daily spin machine. If they throw something out there and it doesn't immediately register big upticks in polling numbers, they're on to something else the next day,
yeah,
screaming about it. So they're trying to since Trump kind of outflanked them on the unemployment stuff, because Nancy was wanting this, like, you know, gift bag of liberal wish lists in order to pass a bill. He just went around him and did it by order because he can under a couple of laws that were already passed.
Yeah.
So now he's got the upper hand about helping people through while they're unemployed. So what do the Democrats do? They start attacking him on the threat that is to Social Security stability. Folks, I got three pieces of news for you.
Yes.
Number one, the Social Security Trust Fund is empty.
And has been.
And has been. We've been borrowing from the general fund to pay Social Security. Start thinking very clearly about not depending upon Social Security for your retirement. And that kind of leads to number two, stop thinking about retirement. Start thinking about what you're going to do to be productive to the end of your days and actually bring in enough money in order to subsist on it. Because if Joe Biden and Kamala Harris win the presidency, life's going to change radically.
Oh, radically, folks.
Radically, folks. And number three, and I want to get back to that radical thing in just a second, but let me segue real quick for number three. Number three, in 2011... President Barack Obama, with the full support of Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden, did exactly the same thing, and they did $1,000. This wasn't on the unemployment trust, and this is on the payroll tax forgiveness.
Right.
You know, because Trump's basically, to the end of the year, said that companies don't have to collect payroll taxes.
But, I'll be paying mine.
again, LLCs and single owner companies will end up having to do it anyway. But the point is that he's waiving the payroll taxes in order to stimulate businesses to get back in and be able to be profitable again in order to get the country back. But it's also to the point of, and they've already signaled this, they are moving toward, if he wins re-election, eliminating the payroll tax entirely. Why bother to have it there? Oh, but it funds Medicare and Social Security. Guess what? Two programs are already bankrupt, folks.
Yeah. Have been.
And have been. And it's all being borrowed from the general fund. But Barack, in 2011, Barack Obama, as part of his jobs package, did a $1,000 payroll tax cut for every individual.
Yep.
And then tried to browbeat the Republicans in Congress to extend it to $1,500 per individual. They didn't seem to think that was going to hurt Social Security
trust fund
at the time.
Boy, no.
And guess how empty the trust fund was in 2011 versus how empty it is in 2020?
At least as empty. Or less empty, actually.
The zero was the same distance around in both instances.
Well, the only thing you say is the minus.
Yeah, the minus has gotten a little bigger.
It's like there was an old man that worked for my dad, an old-time pharmacist. He was actually a patent medicine guy who had owned a drugstore back in the days before the FDA and all that stuff. So this is how old this fellow was.
He's, sure.
This is in the 70s. He was probably born about 1885 or so. And so he worked for Dad.
Yeah.
He knew what he was doing. The joke was, he would tell these stories about how he had all his money buried in cans in the yard. And that he'd forget and he'd go dig one up and it had a note in it that said, ha ha, spent it already. Well, that's what you got. You got a bunch of tin cans with nothing in them that have notes in them that said, ha ha, spent it already.
That's right. Oh, was that the lockbox thing that Al Gore was talking about?
Yeah. Put it in a lockbox.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, the money was never going to come out. Remember that?
Right.
It was going to go into Social Security and sit there and grow and blah, blah, blah. Look, folks, here's the bottom line. Here's the stupid thing. If you were required to put that money plus the employer contribution, and don't forget about the employer contribution, it's half your Social Security.
That's right.
If you were required to put that in a 401k or the rough equivalent of that, you would have millions of dollars to retire on.
Absolutely would.
But the fact is that money goes into the general fund. It has for decades.
Let's also talk about the money that goes into Medicare. Okay.
Same.
It comes out of the same sources. The payroll tax, the contribution, and it's contributed by both the employee and the employer. If you took that money, both sides of that money, and you put it into a healthcare savings account, an HSA.
Yeah.
First of all, the cost of medical services would be reduced because you would be able to negotiate better.
Yes.
Individually, it wouldn't be insurance companies telling doctors what they're willing to pay and then the doctors charging you five times that amount in order to try to get that amount. And you would be able to have better control over your healthcare. So let's say you did contract COVID. Under an HSA, you could probably go to your doctor and request hydroxychloroquine and Zithromax as
vitamin D and zinc.
Vitamin as remedies.
Right.
Nowadays, under managed care and insurance companies, oh, we can't do that because we're in these states. We're going to ban this stuff, so we're going to put you in here and put you on a ventilator and shoot you up full of drugs and see if you survive it.
And a lot of people didn't survive it.
Yeah, absolutely. So you got to understand, folks. Social Security, Medicare, and a number of other federal programs, it's the socialism that the Antifa movement is actually wanting to finalize, not begin. We've been under a socialist rubric in this country since the 30s.
Yeah, really? You could go back to the progressive era at the beginning. I mean,
teens and 20s. Yeah.
Okay. 1913, the graduated income tax.
That's right. That was under William Howard Taft.
No, that was yes.
Yeah, it was William Howard Taft.
And barely. It passed under Taft, and it took effect under Wilson.
Under Wilson, yes.
People blame Wilson for that. You're right.
No, it's Taft.
Taft. And who, by the way, I always laugh about this. In the election of 1912, there were four candidates running. The four candidates were Eugene V. Debs, mm-hmm. Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and Woodrow Wilson.
Right.
Do you know who the least progressive member candidate there was?
Wilson.
It was Woodrow Wilson who ran as a Cleveland Democrat. Now, that may not mean anything to you, those of us who have studied the history. Grover Cleveland was a great president.
Yeah, he was.
He cut government. He cut taxes.
He's only second in my estimation to Calvin Coolidge.
He was a really truly a great president. And the beauty of Grover Cleveland was he got to be president. He's actually counted as two numbers.
That's right.
Because there was an intervening president, and if we ever talk again about the Electoral College, which we probably will, we'll discuss how that happened to Grover Cleveland. Because he was president, and then he got beat, and then he was president again.
Yep.
And truly a great president. But Woodrow Wilson ran as a Cleveland Democrat.
Right.
And he became Theodore Roosevelt as he got into his administration. Yeah. So he did what happens a lot. He quote-unquote grew in the office.
Yeah, yes. He became more progressive.
Which often happens. But this doesn't need to be the case with the current set of Democratic candidates. Because,
oh, my God, if any of them grow in office, Chuck, we're doomed.
Yes. Well, look, here are the facts. You're being taught, if you watch the evening news or listen on the radio, you're being told that both Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are centrists.
Well, yeah, as I mentioned, the New York Times and others are doing an incredible spin job right now trying to ignore the long track record of... Now, again, if you look back at what Tulsi Gabbard did to Kamala Harris, and I'm going to say Kamala, I don't care.
Yeah, whatever.
To Kamala Harris on her record as the prosecutor in L.A. and the attorney general in California.
Oh, yeah.
She nailed her on the crime issues and on the marijuana and everything else. And I guess if you looked at what she did back then, that would make her a centrist in the Democratic Party right now.
Yeah, here's the deal, Barry. There's an old saying, these scales are sliding.
They are.
There are no
sliding,
absolutes on these scales. The fact is, if your position is that of Mao Zedong or Joseph Stalin, everybody looks to the right.
That's true.
The fact is that to the news media, who are on the extreme left, both those might look more centrist than they are. It's hard to imagine with Harris.
It is.
Honestly, that's just propaganda on their part. They know better. They know she's an ultra progressive who has no. Now, did she? You know, the big thing. One of the big things that got her was the fact that she had vigorously prosecuted marijuana cases.
Yes.
In a state where marijuana possession has really been, nobody's really looked very hard at it for 20 years. But why did she do that? So she could come across as a law and order candidate. Now, to show you what's fake about that, what did she do about gun cases? Well, she cooked up a decree wherein if you had ever taken an antidepressant for something, not even necessarily for depression or some, there are people that give you antidepressants for things like blood pressure and that kind of stuff, because I've had that happen. I had somebody prescribed Zoloft, I think, for blood pressure, and you know what I did about it? Nothing. I didn't have the prescription filled.
Yeah.
But right. If anybody'd ever been, she went around and confiscated their guns.
Yeah, that's right.
On the basis that they clearly had a mental illness. Not so much. But that's the quote-unquote law and order candidacy of Kamala Harris.
Yeah, so again, I do tremble for the country, Chuck. If this country goes completely insane and we have mail-in only balloting, which sounds like a lot of Republicans are going for, like our governor and our Secretary of State, and the Antifa and BLM folks do things to threaten, you know, the closure of polling places. And somebody came across the other day as, why are we now staying in COVID? We're going to delay opening schools and all these other places. Well, guess what? They're polling places too.
Yeah, sure.
So there's going to be a problem there. So if we do all this and we end up with the Democrat ticket as it is right now, or with Michelle Obama winning this election, folks, the people who are out there protesting right now, the Antifas and the BLMs, will be running your government. And how are you going to fare? How's your family going to fare? How's your job or your business going to fare? How is your way of life going to fare? How's your future going to look if we let people who are willing to rob, pillage, burn, and kill in order to get their political point across, if you hand them the levers of power?
Look, we've already got people shooting at helicopters in Virginia.
Right.
And by the way, Fairfax County, Virginia, just sent letters to the parents of children that says, if you can afford to buy, to hire a tutor for your children. Please don't, because it's unfair to the children whose parents cannot afford to hire them a tutor. Even though we're not opening the school, don't hire a tutor, because it's unfair.
I would look at them and say, you actually have no business telling me what to do with my own child, because because if you're not having my child in school, you're not operating in loco parentis. Operating in loco.
Well, guess what? We're out of time. You know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.